Why I Hear You Cry. Are we using as the theme tonight, the theme from a quite mediocre musical, starring Sid Charisse, Van Heflin and some other fella? Well, it's because, as you know, Brigadoon tells the story of a lovely Scottish village which vanishes into the mists of time to re-emerge every 100 years or so. And I thought it was appropriate because it raises the question whether the thrilling concept or notion, ideal, dream of Scottish independence will now fade into the mists of time. Later, I'll welcome back to the program Leslie Riddick. It's Leslie's third appearance, energetic and, yes, disappointed, yes, campaigner. And you may be surprised by recent developments. Some extraordinary things have happened in the last 3 days. The other possibility for a theme was me playing a solo on a ram's horn, the shofar, that wonderful instrument, because this is, of course, Rosh Hashanah. It's Jewish New Year, and I wish the Jewish Gladys a very happy New Year. Of course, you know, we Christians are Johnny Come, not that I'm a Christian, but I'm speaking in generic terms, we Goy. You know, we've only been around for 2014 years. It is, in fact, the year 5774 for Jews, and the sound of the shofar will be resonating through many a synagogue. Tonight, anti-terrorism laws. In just a minute, Kieran Hardy and Dr. Patrick Emerton. Then, an extraordinary and improbable story about renegade Amish. They can be pretty dangerous characters, the Amish. They're not quite the sweet creatures we saw in Peter Weir's film, Witness, with Harrison Ford. But first, lawyers, governments have always struggled with the legalities of political surveillance. And when it comes to the new terrorism laws being introduced in Australia this week, there's certainly a major struggle. Any statement to the Parliament on Monday, our PM repeated a well-worn mantra that there's a tension between national security and civil liberties. He said, regrettably, for some time to come, the delicate balance between freedom and security may have to shift. Now, tonight we're going to explain what that delicate or perhaps indelicate balance or delicate unbalance is about by backgrounding the new anti-terrorism laws, the National Security Legislation Amendment Bill, and the Counter-Terrorism Foreign Fighters Bill. Now, to guide us through the complex maze, on the phone we have Kieran Hardy, a research associate in law from the University of New South Wales, and in our Melbourne studio, Dr. Patrick Emerton from Monash University Law School. Gentlemen, welcome to our Little Wireless program. Kieran, you helped write a submission for the parliamentary inquiry on the national security legislation that just been introduced into Parliament. Your concerns were about computer security and media freedom. Do those concerns still exist?
Yeah, thanks for having me on the program. We wrote a submission as part of the Gilbert and Tobin Centre of Public Law, a few members, looking precisely at those issues. So computer network, access to computer networks by virtue of warrants through the Australian Security Intelligence Organisation, ASIO, and then disclosure offences for a range of matters for intelligence officers. But also a special provision attached to disclosure offence attached to what are called special intelligence operations, which are authorised, you know, special undercover operations authorised for ASIO to do. So the committee was, I guess, in evidence. They were very supportive of lots of the ideas we raised. But for the most part, I think the bill will be passed in the form that it was presented with some important amendments as well.
And should we be very concerned about this, Kieran, or just roll over?
Well, I think part of the issue, we have to be clear about the difference between the bill which is currently before Parliament, which is the National Security Legislation Amendment Bill, number one, which deals with computer network access, disclosure offences, special intelligence operations, which has been looked at by the Parliamentary Joint Committee on Intelligence and Security, And that's separate to, although obviously this bill that has received a lot more attention, the Foreign Fighters Bill, will build on that and be introduced tomorrow. And I suspect what will happen will be that while there are a lot of really serious issues with that first bill, I think a lot of this second bill coming through will somewhat overshadow those issues.
Patrick, in what's being introduced, is it radically different to previous national security bills that have existed in our wide brown land?
I'd say it extends what we already have. It extends it in a direction that's been ongoing since 2002, and my view is that it's a worrying direction. I think it's contrary to constitutional values. Sometimes the Australian Constitution is derided as very dry and we don't have values. I'm someone who thinks that's not true. We do have values, and the tendency of this legislation, in my view, is to undermine them. Undermines values of citizenship, undermines values around the integrity of the operation of executive agencies, blurs the line between spying and policing, and certainly the National Security Legislation Amendment Bill number 1 goes further in terms of blurring that line.
Patrick, I understand that your a major concern for you is the lack of oversight. Who's watching the watchers?
Yes, so for example, Kieran already mentioned these new proposed special intelligence operations. So these are called controlled operations when police do them, and they authorise the authorities to do unlawful things without getting in trouble for it. For police, there's a strong discipline on that, which is that police are engaged in investigating crimes with the aim of prosecuting in a court. And so the integrity of that judicial process filters down through the policing culture, through the policing institution, to create a constraint on what the police do and what they can do and what they want to do. If they go too far outside those constraints, they become self-defeating because their evidence won't be admissible in court. ASIO isn't a police agency. It's not answerable to courts. It's not subject to that same constitutional discipline that police are subject to. That means that it's an invitation to ASIO to go on frolics of its own. Already in 2007...
And some of us remember previous frolics by ASIO over the decades, if not the generations.
Yeah, well, I'm thinking in particular the most recent one I know of is 2007. The Justice Adams of the New South Wales Supreme Court threw out a prosecution because the evidence of the prosecution was tainted by kidnapping and false imprisonment, so serious crimes committed by ASIO officers in the course of the collection of evidence. So the solution to that isn't simply to make kidnapping lawful when ASIO does it.
Kieran, can you compare what's happening now to what happened in the 50s with ASIO and the Communist Party? Is this legislation more restrictive than that used to collect information on me and my mates?
I think there are some key differences in terms of so the new offences that are coming out in particular now with regard to obviously the increased role for criminal offences for overseas activities, those kind of things. But I guess you can draw that parallel and say, well, criminalising organisations, these kind of status offences of membership and other things. I guess you can draw a parallel along those lines, although some things definitely. Over time, there hasn't necessarily been a trend towards, a reining in of ASIO's powers over the decades, or they might have expected that. Yeah, as Patrick mentioned, definitely special intelligence operations, lack of oversight, these kinds of issues are becoming really important.
Patrick, would you like to add to that?
Yeah, well, I think that the communists were self-consciously oppositional. And that meant to some extent they expected to be hounded by Special Branch and by ASIO. But the way that ASIO's intelligence gathering works at the moment is it targets people who don't see themselves as oppositional within Australia. They see themselves as Australians, living their lives as Australians. It's because of their connections to foreign matters that they come onto ASIO's radar. And so we have an emerging notion that you're citizenship rights, if you like, and whether or not you're a criminal, turn not on your commitment to Australia and to Australia's constitutional values, but turn on your commitment to foreign affairs issues and whether your views align with, if you like, a foreign affairs majority view or a foreign affairs minority view. And again, I think that's unhealthy in a pluralist democracy.
Okay, the Counterterrorism Foreign Fighters Bill, still to come before Parliament. What do we know about it that's different to what's in place now?
So So for it will have new offences, but I think most significantly it will, if I haven't had a chance to read the bill in detail, I've looked at the Attorney General's press release, it, as has been foreshadowed, it will allow the declaration of certain areas overseas as sort of areas where it's criminal for people to go to. And this again reinforces that notion that criminality under Australian law is going to turn not on a person's relationship to the Australian body politic or to their conduct in Australia, but will turn on their relationship and connections to events overseas.
Now
that's
a new
thing in Australia.
Sorry, you work a lot among ethnic groups in Melbourne.
Yes.
And you must be picking up concerns.
Definitely picking up concerns. So in the past when I've people spoken to teachers and principals in Islamic schools, it seems that sort of every second person there and every second young man there has had contact from ASIO. For what reason? Those people aren't criminals. They're not disloyal Australians. They have opinions about the merits of various disputes overseas. But traditionally in Australia, it hasn't been a criterion for being a non-criminal or being a good citizen in Australia that you share the views of the government, even if the government and the opposition, on foreign policy matters.
One of the big problems with the Foreign Fighters Bill is the shift of the onus of proof. Brander says there'll be no change, but not all of us believe him.
So there are various reverse onus and quasi-reverse onus provisions already in play in our terrorism laws, so it wouldn't be a surprise to see more things structured in that way. One, moving sort of from values to technicalities, a recurring difficulty with Australia's terrorism laws is that they are incredibly complex in their drafting, very hard for police and lawyers and judges to understand. In the Lodi trial in Sydney, the difficulties of interpretation came through with multiple appeals and rehearings over issues of interpretation and proper understanding of the laws. I saw that the Attorney General, in his new legislation, is also proposing to try and breathe new life into preventative detention orders. In an inquiry into those orders undertaken a few years ago now by the New South Wales Ombudsman, that office reached the conclusion police would never use preventative detention orders because an ordinary police officer was simply not capable of understanding the complexities of their legal regime, that they would stick to the ordinary law of arrest for ordinary criminal offences, such as, for example, assault and murder.
Kieran, onus of proof.
Yeah, we've only received the bill tonight, so I've got it in front of me now, but I haven't had a chance to read through the 160-odd pages of it. But I think the onus of proof issue is, so I think Brandis has made the point that this is not technically reversing the onus of proof, and we can have a semantic debate about that. But, you know, on anybody's view, it's quite an extraordinary offence to say that if you enter or remain in a country that has been declared, you know, as a specified area for the purposes of the legislation, and then what you would have to do would be to, so there are a range of exceptions like providing aid of a humanitarian nature for official duties, being a journalist, bona fide visit to family members, and you would have, the accused would have an evidentiary burden, which means they need to show enough information or evidence to say that, you know, there's a possibility that this was really the case, and then the Crown would have to negativize the existence of that defence. So whichever way you look at it, I mean, you can have a debate about whether that means you've reversed the onus of proof or not, but I think it's very clear that the offence will apply prima facie, you know, on the face of it, it will apply so long as you enter or remain in that country, and then there will be a burden on the accused to show that they were there for a legitimate reason.
LNL on N, and my guests are Kieran Hardy, UNSW Law Research Associate, and Dr. Patrick Emerton, Patrick Senior Lecturer in the Monash Faculty of Law. Patrick, clarification. You believe there's a lack of legal discipline in the National Security Bill because it's taken control away from courts, giving it to the executive government. Am I right in saying that people affected by this legislation will have no right to challenge ASIO's assessment via the courts?
So in terms of the National Security Legislation Bill, so the main way people become affected by that is to either be spied upon or to get caught up in the special operations, the sort of the secret criminality. There are opportunities to challenge that in the federal courts as problematic administrative action. the practical difficulty, and it's been a recurrent difficulty, and it came out, for example, with the expulsion from Australia of the US peace activist Scott Parkins a few years ago, is that because of the secrecy of ASIO's operations, it's very difficult to get evidence into a courtroom as to what was going on and to whether or not they were behaving themselves lawfully. And again, I think that brings out the contrast between ASIO as an agency and, for example, police. Police are, at least in principle, open. Evidence can be led. ASIO is in principle secret. That's their job, is to be secret. In the past, the way we handled that is we didn't give them the power to search people. We didn't give them the power to use force against people. This new legislation lets them use force against people, increases their power to search people. So it sets up a sort of a covert police force, not subject to that public discipline that our ordinary police are subject to.
Kieran, before we wind this up, and we haven't got a lot of time, I remember the media for, well, forever, bowed a knee to the old D notice, which the general public barely knew existed. Now there's section 35P. Is it worse than the D notice in the way it will restrict media coverage of intelligence?
I think its effect might be more indirect than direct, in the sense that I think what will happen for the most part is I think journalists will be quite wary about publishing anything that relates to an operation in which ASIO is involved, because what you would need to show is that the person, that the journalist was, for example, was reckless as to the fact that that information related to a special intelligence operation. So, you know, that might mean you suspect there needs to be a substantial risk that it relates to a special intelligence operation. I don't think that would be too hard to prove in such a situation. So I think what will happen will be there might be self-censorship, in the sense that I don't want to disclose information that could relate to a special intelligence operation. I think that's how it will.
But self-censorship is often the most subtle and the most... Anyway, I've never liked it much. Look, you two are going to be very busy for the next week or so. Thank you for finding time for the Little Wireless program. Kieran Hardy and Dr. Patrick Emerton. LNL on RN. Happy New Year to my Jewish gladdies. And coming up, a very strange story about the Amish.